This was in our news. Just 2 weeks ago, Governor Lamont announced in an effort to protect Connecticut from a growing rise of dangerous anti-Semitic incidents happening on college campuses, he organized a meeting of security officials representing public and private higher education institutions across our state to not only discuss, but also look at methods to prevent any more incidents of hate happening on college campuses in Connecticut. Gary McNamara happens to be part of that group. And so I've been wanting to have Gary to come on to talk about this and what methods are being discussed for all college campuses in Connecticut. Gary McNamara, thank you so much. Welcome back. How are you?
I am fine, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. And I want to just remind folks that Gary is the former chief of police for Fairfield, but he also is currently with Sacred Heart University, part of their public safety command staff. He is the chief and executive director of public safety and government affairs. Gary, you get the call from Governor Lamont that he wants to bring together all of these public safety officials and talk about hate crimes on college campuses. What was your first thought about this, and what are you seeing at your own college campus? Is this existing at Sacred Heart?
Well, first of all, the universities all collectively meet regularly, their public safety on a variety of issues. And so, it's not uncommon for us to meet and discuss any issue. Having this at a statewide level is important because it highlights it at that state level. So my first thought was, yay, let's have it. As you know, I'm on the Hate Crime Council for the state. So I represent I'm one of the members that represent law enforcement. So we meet regularly as another group for the past two years trying to work on hate crime legislation, combating it, information, and how to get a handle on it. So it's certainly something that we've discussed about quite a bit.
Is this something that is existing currently, do you feel, at Sacred Heart, or have, what are other colleges seeing?
Yeah, we have not seen this level of hate crime on campus. We're talking that in some areas of the country, it's increased by about 388%. So that's a significant jump, mostly anti-Israeli or anti-Jewish hate crime. So that we've seen that. We have not seen that on campus. Now, that's not to say that it doesn't exist. Part of the problem with hate crimes is that a couple things. Number one, it's underreported nationwide because people are afraid to come forward and report it. Secondly, regardless of whether it's occurring to you personally, either on campus or in your communities, when you see that, you become fearful, and it really affects, in some regards, it can affect people day to day. So it might not be occurring at our university, but to hear stories about it occurring at other universities, we'd be neglectful if we didn't say we have to do all we can to keep it that way and to reach out to the communities that may feel that they could be subject of hate crimes and make sure that we're meeting with them, we're supporting them, and at the same time supporting all the students and clarifying what's appropriate behavior and what's not appropriate behavior.
So, Gary, it was interesting. Last week there was a story out of UConn where they went to the – I mean, there was a group of students that had to go to the level of FBI. They went above their own security detail and even above Connecticut detail. They went to the FBI because there were some students who were being targeted by phone calls and other means of threats because of what's going on between Israel and Hamas. And I didn't know what kind of methods can we really deploy? Like, what is being discussed at the state level of combating this issue?
Well, first of all, on a college campus, we have to make it clear what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. And then also keep in mind that there is federal regulation, and Title IX is a large regulation that impacts universities. But under Title IX, and it deals with students, and specifically we deal with it a lot if there's a sexual assault or harassment of students. But there are sections of Title IX that deal with anti-Semitism and other hate issues. So Title IX can be kicked in with some of the regulations. But I think collectively as a state and as a university, we all want to get together and appropriately send the message to all of our students that this shouldn't exist. These are the ways to report it. This is what will happen to you if you engage in it, and then act on it. Act on it. If we find somebody that's committing a hate crime, then they have to be held accountable, because it's important that we send that message. And then again, like I said, at the same time, we have to support those students who we may not even think are impacted by it, but are.
Honestly, though, and we have Gary McNamara here, who is the Chief and Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University. He also happens to be a member of the Hate Crime Council here for the state of Connecticut. And they're talking about ways to combat hate crimes, not just at college campuses, but at the state level with better legislation. Gary, I got to be honest, though, this seems like pretty logical stuff. You know, when we talk about let's outline what is appropriate on college campuses, I'm pretty sure anyone with half a brain would know that you shouldn't be sending threatening messages on social media, over the phone, in the mail, at people's dorm rooms, saying that we hate you, we hate your people, you know, we'll hurt you, whatever messages are out there. This seems pretty logical. And it just seems like it's gotten out of hand, not just in Connecticut, but across the country, where this, to me, like, what is the... What happens to a student who is caught doing something like this? Because I would think my five-year-old would know you can't say things like this. So what are the repercussions of these kinds of threats on campus?
Well, first of all, back up a little bit. You're right. Some of this stuff is logical, and it's complicated, Melissa. I mean, you know, hate crime is very complicated because, you know, are people doing it because they truly hate, or are they doing it to be malicious? Regardless of intent, it doesn't necessarily matter, but it's very complicated in the sense that, as we've seen across the country, it can become pretty prevalent. And so, yeah, you know, whitewashing it or sugarcoating it and saying, hey, you know, this is what will happen to you, you shouldn't do it. Yeah, there's a deeper issues that this phone call or the meeting we're having in the state are not going to conquer it. You know, what will begin to conquer it will be to be unified, not only on college campuses, but in different groups that get together, that continue to meet and develop strategies and plans to combat it. You know, a student can be disciplined. You know, now there's a difference between a hate crime and a hate incident. And a hate incident is something that might not necessarily be a crime, but it's still something that we have to understand. So that could be anything from someone sticking a flyer into an envelope, into your mailbox. And you may
that's
not
a hate
be
incident because you're it allowed to put yeah. you're allowed to put flyers yeah. wherever you want. That's free speech. I see.
Right. But it's still important to understand that and to track that, because it hate incidents could be a symptom of a real deep seated hate crime syndicate or other people that are really involved in hate crime that are trying to recruit or trying to do other things. Now, I'm not saying that all of those are just hate incidents, not a crime. Depending upon why it's put in there and the motive behind it could make that a crime. If they're targeting a specific house or if there is someone who's Jewish in that house, that might change the dynamics from an incident to a hate crime. But we have to get our hands around what are hate incidents that are occurring, and then at the same time, what are hate crimes.
News that really matters, not just here in Connecticut, but across the country, is the increase of hate crimes and hate incidents happening on college campuses, including even right here in Connecticut. We have Gary McNamara here. He is actually a member of the Hate Crime Council for Connecticut. He also is the Chief and Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University. So, Gary, let's go back to you. We're talking about there's a difference between hate incidents and hate crimes. Okay, I'm with you on that. That's fine. But what about if a hate incident leads to a student who doesn't want to leave their dorm room, doesn't want to continue even working at that institution, going to school at that institution? Does that then become a hate crime?
No, probably not. I mean, you know, they could be gripped by fear. I mean, it could. There's so many different. It really matters on the intent of the behavior. So it can be difficult to decipher. So that is a whole nother issue. And, you know, I mentioned Title IX. Title VI is the civil – so there's civil rights implications for universities as it relates to these type of incidents. But, you know, Melissa, a lot of times we have conversations where I can come on and provide at least what I believe to be significant, you know, to-do lists, like steps. You know, you can check off a step list, and these are the things that will help. Mm. This is so challenging because it's challenging. And, you know, I think it goes towards culture. I think universities have to front load things. You know, we have a diversity and equity inclusion focus at the university, and other universities do as well. but you have to kind of have these things in place beforehand so that you understand and can adjust and appropriately if these things begin to spike on campus. So, you know, it goes back to some of the old adages of, you know, we are raised to be kind and to understand differences. And when there are challenges, we have to be able to pivot and address them. The good news about the meetings and the state level meetings is that we are all saying that we're not going to tolerate it and we're looking for solutions. So I don't think there's going to be one solution that will ever solve all this hate directed towards other individual groups. But certainly the culture matters, having mechanisms in place to report it, having faculty, staff, public safety know the signs and symptoms of what you're talking about. If someone's staying in their room because they're fearful, understanding hate incidents, hate crimes, and understanding what to do if they encounter something is really going to go a long way to addressing at least some of the problems, specifically on campus.
And I think, too, that not that anyone asked for my opinion, but I feel like there's a lot of loopholes. You know, so, for example, when you go back to that UConn story of kids who are getting threatening phone calls because they're Jewish, or they're getting flyers put on their dorm room doors because they're Jewish. And the people who are putting those flyers out or sending those messages essentially get a slap on the wrist. That's not nice. You shouldn't do that. Well, freedom of speech. All right, fine. I guess it's over. I mean, it's just gotten so, I think, politically out of hand, which is beyond your pay grade. I'm not looking for you, Gary, to solve, you know, world peace. I'm not looking for you to find that. But I just think it's gotten so difficult for colleges, I would think, to find methods to combat the problem. And I'm curious how much harder it has gotten for people like you to not only handle what's happening, but to also deal with social media having a huge impact on where students stand and how much of an outreach they have with their religious or political thoughts and attacking other people if they don't agree with them. How hard has it gotten for you to do your job because of social media?
Well, everything's gotten harder because, you know, universities are not a bubble. You know, you bring people in as freshmen and they grow together as adults and they move forward together, but they always are impacted by outside influences. And social media allows people to do that quite regularly. And so, yeah, it's very challenging because even though you think you have a handle on your culture within your university, there's always the ability for people to reach within because of the internet. And some of it very vile and hate-filled that, you know, you can influence people from your kitchen table. And that's a lot of the challenges. And so the messages, again, you know, I don't mean to go back to messaging, but messaging has to be pretty clear that it's not going to be tolerated. And slaps on the wrist, frankly, don't matter. They shouldn't be a slap on the wrist. Because if you do it, you're impacting students that we don't even know are impacted, to your point. Mm-hmm. Students who are fearful to go to class, students who aren't studying because they're fearful, students who have family members who are worried and are demanding they come home. And, you know, I mean, it goes on and on. Unless you're experiencing that fear, you don't understand it. And so we have to be strong and really enforce if behavior crosses the line. And mm-hmm. You're right, there's challenges with the First Amendment, and that's kind of some of the challenges that we're all going to have to face. But at some point, we have to hold people accountable for the behavior that's affecting the lives of others for no reason other than what they believe, who they are, or whatever. We have to at some point address those issues and make sure we define them appropriately, message it appropriately, have people understand where to report it, and they feel comfortable reporting it. And then it's up to us to take action to make sure that those people who are doing it are held accountable so that all the other people who are potentially affected by it can go about their college careers without having to worry about it.
So this is an ongoing conversation with leaders across Connecticut trying to combat these hate incidents and making sure that the messaging is very clear for all college campus students. And we know, Gary, that there's another upcoming meeting that's going to be happening among the leaders like you, as well as the new commissioner. And so we look forward to hearing what comes out of meetings like that this week and in the near future. And I thank you so much for outlining, you know, where you're coming from at Sacred Heart and what's being discussed at the state level. people with this issue. So I appreciate you sharing that on WICC.
You got it, Melissa. Melissa, sometimes the most challenging problems are followed up by the most important conversations, and this is one of them that we should continue to have.
I agree. Absolutely. Welcome back anytime, Gary McNamara. Always love having you. Thank you so much. We got some pretty alarming statistics thanks to Fairfield County's Community Foundation. It says that here in Fairfield County, black women are 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than their white peers. Low birth weight rates for black babies are twice that of white babies, and the infant mortality rate for black babies is 3 times that of white babies. And so today, there's a really exciting initiative that is kicking off. It is the Black Maternal Health Initiative, which is a collaborative effort designed to really address these disparities in maternal outcomes for Fairfield County. And to talk to us a little bit more about this is Mendy Blupaka, who is the CEO and president of Fairfield County Community Foundation. And we thank you so much, Mendy, for making the time to come on WICC. How are you?
Hi, Melissa. I'm doing well. Thank you very much for having me. This is a really exciting moment for us here at the foundation.
This is an amazing initiative, and we're going to talk about it in just one moment. But before we do that, what made FCCF focus on black maternal health? What brought you to that realization? Those are some pretty stark numbers that we just shared a couple seconds ago.
Yeah, indeed they are. Fairfield County's Community Foundation, what we do is we partner with our community to create a region where every person has an equitable opportunity to thrive. And so we do that by working closely with community organizations, nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists to address challenges and identify opportunities to create a stronger, more vibrant community here in Fairfield County. And, you know, you just cited some of the most powerful and daunting statistics. And so, you know, once we hear numbers like that, we really feel it's unacceptable to stand by, frankly, and allow these conditions to continue without doing something to address that. And, you know, as a mother and for all the mothers who are listening today and know this very well, having a child can really be a life-changing experience. And it's a journey that's extremely hard to navigate alone. And it's especially dangerous and difficult to navigate if you're trying to do so in systems that weren't really built with your interests in mind. And as you pointed out, we really do have severe racial disparities for mothers in our community. And so we wanted to sort of figure out how we as a foundation could get at the root of that, address some of the discrimination and bias throughout our social systems, and especially in our healthcare system, to try to counteract what we're seeing happening. So we're really excited today to launch this Black Maternal Health Initiative and improve maternal outcomes for Black mothers and Black babies.
Mendy, how is this possible? How in 2023 in America can Black women be 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than people who are white?
Yeah, so I think sometimes we tend to think that sort of systems and structures that were created in the past have no bearing on us today. And it's really just not the case. And so, you know, there was a time not so long ago that Black women and white women couldn't even give birth in the same hospitals. You know, my own grandmother, actually, great-grandmother, was a midwife in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And she was the only Black midwife in that community for many years, and had to deliver all the Black babies because they couldn't get the same quality of care and access. So fast forward to today, you know, something certainly has changed and women are birthing in the same facilities. But there's still a lot of underlying discrimination and bias. There's a lot of data surrounding, you know, sort of assumptions that are made when Black women express pain or communicate about their concerns. They're often not listened to or prioritized. And one of the really fascinating in a negative way pieces surrounding that point is that's really true irrespective of income or education. You know, some of us may have seen up at the national level, you know, some famous Black women like Serena Williams, for example, who experienced, you know, significant birthing crises and felt that their concerns weren't being listened to when they raised them. So that is largely at the root of the problem.
I think, and again, I'm not discrediting anything you just said, because I think we know there's an issue of even getting access to prenatal care is a huge one that I know has been an issue for a very long time. But advocating for moms in general is so awful, I think, across the board. I'm not black, but I do know for myself that I almost lost my life having my son 5 years ago because doctors would not listen, because doctors did not do the protocols that should have been in place. And this was out of state. This wasn't here in Connecticut. So I know, just in general, how do we better advocate and have that better communication for mothers who are, or expecting mothers who are just trying to have a normal and healthy birthing experience? How do we improve that?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question. And I'm glad you said what you did say, because I think what the data shows us is that the experience is particularly harsh and difficult and dangerous for Black women, but that doesn't mean that it's easy for any women, right? And to your point, as a country, we certainly see maternal health outcomes overall that are much poorer than most of our peers and in the developed world. And so I think it's important to note, for that reason, that our focus on improving Black maternal health in our community will actually enhance life for everyone. Mm-hmm. So it fosters cohesion, it increases quality of life, and perhaps most importantly, and this might speak a bit to your experience, I think it improves empathy and compassion, and that will improve birthing experiences for all women, because I don't know what your exact story was. I certainly have my own long, very complicated stories around reproduction, most of which were quite difficult as well. And I think just a bit more compassion and empathy would have probably gone a long way in those experiences. So our hope is that this will indeed do that for all women. And I think the second part of the question you asked me is, so how do we do that? Was that, yeah.
Yeah, how do you, does that come down to training? Does that come down to, you know, even at the level of when nurses and doctors are going through college and whatever, like, is that what we're talking about? How do we better create, like you said, empathy? Some of that's natural, but some of that has to also be, I would think, trained.
Yes, indeed. And so what our coalition is actually going to start with is really reflecting, I think, on the power of collaboration. And so at the core of this work is bringing together those providers that you've referenced, along with people like doulas, and not just doctors and nurses in hospitals, but also the frontline staff and federally qualified health centers, advocacy organizations who can really speak to sort of the laws and the policy that impacts it, and our Fund for Women and Girls, of course, as well. And so together, this coalition is really going to be working to improve care and support. And I think with these partners at the table, we will be able to drive lasting change. And so the first area that we're actually going to start in is promoting the expansion of doula care for mothers. And for those who don't know what doulas are or who they are, doulas are really important. I didn't have a doula. I really wish I had a doula, but they play a critical role in promoting health equity by providing culturally matched care. But just in general, they also provide dignity and trust and autonomy, and they really focus more than anything on relationships with women. And so that is the goal. So if there's a healthcare provider that is really focused on you and your relationship and getting to know you and understand you and build that capacity with you, then when you do raise concerns, there is a much higher level of that empathy and care. And the other sort of really interesting critical piece of what doulas do is they help alert healthcare providers to symptoms and concerns that lead to maternal morbidity and mortality in some cases. So that's the core of our initiative as we start. So we're going to start by strengthening the local birthing force to hire and train more doulas, to advocate for policies that will enable that, which is something that we've been doing for quite some time already, including getting doulas to be able to be reimbursed by insurance, which is a major challenge. And we did have some strides in that last legislative session. And we're going to collect data that will reflect to us how families and women are experiencing their birthing experiences at hospitals, because that's really what it comes down to. You know, our goal is for all women to have the best opportunity to have a joyful birth. And, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if the experience of becoming a mother could really be joyful for all women?
No, absolutely. It certainly should be. So a new health initiative is kicking off today, and it's thanks to Fairfield County's Community Foundation's Fund for Women and Girls, Black Maternal Health. We shared earlier in this segment that Black women are 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than their white peers, and the infant mortality rate for Black babies is 3 times that of white babies, which is just extraordinary in 2023 here in America. We have Mendy Blue Paca here, who is the president and CEO of the Fairfield County's Community Foundation. And we're just starting to get into what this initiative is going to mean. And it's, again, kicking off today, and you can register to join them for today's event. Mendy, let's talk about, if you don't mind, informing people about the importance of prenatal, for example. Do you think that that's done well enough for all mothers, for Black mothers, white mothers? Do you think that the importance of prenatal care and the access to it is equal, is out there?
Absolutely not. So that is a huge concern. And one of the things that we do know is that, you know, we talk a lot sort of about early childhood education in our culture, which is important because that sort of 1 to 3 year old period is really critical for future life outcomes. But it's really actually 0 to 3. And it's those first 9, 10 months in utero that begin to play a tremendous role in shaping outcomes for children. And so it's critical that mothers have adequate health, that they're caring for themselves properly, that they're getting their necessary vaccinations and other treatment. And we know that's just not happening to the level that it is in our communities. Actually, you know, as you pointed out, the share of births with late or, in fact, no prenatal care is more than twice as high for Black mothers as white mothers, so 7% compared to 3%. But frankly, no woman should be having late or no prenatal care. And so we have to do a better job of communicating to women around the importance of this and providing greater access.
But why does that happen, Mendy? So why would Black mothers not know about prenatal care to help people understand why there's such a huge disparity?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it goes to sort of what the care looks like before birth. And so that comes down to sort of questions of sort of access to coverage and having frankly, things like community health workers who are embedded in both the health system and communities where many women live, so that they can become sort of ambassadors between the two. And I think you have to consider that for many women, and Black women in particular, if your experience in the health system hasn't been a positive one, and it's one in which, as we discussed earlier, you often don't feel there's a high amount of empathy or compassion for you or in your situation, or you feel like when you raise concerns, people don't listen to you or aren't responsive to them, that's not going to create in a lot of women an urge to go seek out that care at a particularly vulnerable time in their life when they're pregnant. So we've got to do a better job of sort of holistic health and making women feel like the doctor's office or the health center that they go to is a place that wants to receive them and wants to help them. And so then it hopefully creates a much more virtuous cycle by the time they really need the care in pregnancy.
And Mendy, if people want to learn more about the Black Maternal Health Initiative or just Fairfield County's Community Foundation, where do they go? Do you have a website or anything?
We do indeed. So, you know, as you shared this morning, we'll be kicking off this initiative at M&T Bank in Bridgeport in just about an hour or so, and we're really excited about that. But also, we need everyone in this community to help us move it forward. It's going to take perseverance and partnership and also resources. And so listeners can actually visit our website, but a specific page for this initiative at sccfoundation.org/BMHI, and BMHI is Black Maternal Health Initiative. And at that site, you can learn more. You can explore ways to get involved. You can even make a donation to our Fund for Women and Girls or our Health Equity Fund to support this work, which really is an investment in the whole health of our region. And so, you know, today's an exciting day. We're kicking it off. And I think this is a problem that, frankly, with the resources and talent in Fairfield County and the scope of our population, we can eliminate these disparities. And that's not something we can say about every issue we work on at the foundation. So with the partnership of your listeners in particular, we really believe we can execute that vision. So we're excited to get started.
Mendy Blupaka, I want to thank you for the work that you do for Fairfield County's Community Foundation, and I'm excited to see what happens with this Black Maternal Health Initiative kicking off later on this morning. Thank you for sharing all this information. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Melissa. My pleasure.
And again, the Fairfield County Community Foundation's Fund for Women and Girls, they're going to be kicking off a Black Maternal Health Initiative today from 9:30 to 11 at M&T Bank at 850 Main Street in Bridgeport. Be sure to check them out online if you want to register ahead of time and check it out and just get involved with the work that they are doing for this. Recently, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that caught my eye. The fight over returning to the office, it's turning into a disability dispute. It's interesting. I know that employment attorneys, even here in Connecticut, have started to get calls about returning to the office. What rights do employees versus employers have with all of that? And we have our own employment attorney that we have on the show very frequently. His name is Gary Phelan. He is an employment attorney with Mitchell and Sheehan. He also is a law adjunct professor, though, at Quinnipiac University. And so Gary joins us to talk about this idea of disability disputes with returning to the office. Hey, Gary, how are you?
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. I don't want to be you in this situation because this has to be really tricky. The idea of are people's rights being infringed upon with disabilities? What would be considered a disability to allow you to work from home now that people are being asked to come back to the office? Not everywhere, but a lot of places of work are kind of over the remote working and they want you in person. So what do you say to this?
Well, this is certainly, I think, the hottest issue in the workplace right now. And so when I get a call, and certainly this has been an issue really for the last 2 years, and it continues to increase. But the first question is, do you have an impairment, you know, that somehow, you know, working from being in the workplace, you know, that is affected, adversely affected by your impairment? And because many of the people who call, it's, you know, the response is, well, no, you know, I just preferred it that way. You know, it really worked out for me. It's not a legal issue. You know, that an employer does have a right to say, you know, we are going to be, you know, the position is in person. Now, what has changed is the number of people with anxiety, depression, any mental health disorder, that has increased, and that's what's led to a 16% increase for all of those impairments with charges being filed with the EEOC. So that's really the threshold question is, do you have, you know, a condition that makes it difficult to work in the workplace?
And I'm not saying, Gary, that people don't, but how do you prove that? Because I remember when growing up, I remember when I was in college and people had dogs in their apartments. And I remember when they were trying to make it so they could say, you know, I have my dog here for anxiety or for whatever. And, oh, my gosh, the amount of people that went to their vets and were like, here, just write a note that says that I need this dog for anxiety to bring their dogs to work with them. And sure, there are people who do that, but there are a lot of people who would abuse that. And so how do you prove that to your workplace that, hey, you know what, I've realized that I have an immense amount of anxiety at this job and it goes away, a lot of it goes away substantially when I work from home. And so now you have to allow me to do my job well. You have to allow me to work from home.
The first issue is there medical documentation of the impairment? And certainly if somebody has had a history of, you know, depression, anxiety, then that's going to bolster their claim. And but that an employer does have a right to say, you know, initially, because an employer doesn't have to accommodate something that's not a disability. So the burden is on the employee to demonstrate that they have a disability. That doesn't rule out the fact that someone might get a letter from a doctor saying that someone, you know, suffered from depression. But, you know, one of the things I also always look at is, did you work in that office before COVID hit? Yes, COVID has been a catalyst for more people with mental health disorders. But, you know, that's one of the important things is if you were able to work in the workplace before COVID, why can't you work in the workplace now?
Well, that's what I mean. I feel like more and more people, once they got a taste of the good life, they want to keep with that. And some industries have said, you know what, we have more productive workers because they are able to work from home. But others have said, you know what, it's important that we have a good culture here, that people see each other. We have meetings in person. They're more effective when we're in person. And some have said a hybrid, you know, whatever. But I think that's the big question, Gary, is do people get a taste of the good life? Okay, I get to work from home, which means I can curate my own schedule. I can, you know, do a lot of different things. And so now I wanna fight to have that stay. So I'm going to plead that I have a disability. Is anxiety and depression, would that even be seen as a disability?
It has to be severe enough to be meet the definition of disability. So just the diagnosis itself is generally not enough. Now, there's not a clear-cut line of, you know, where that line is drawn as far as is it severe enough. But that's certainly a factor. But you're right. The, you know, one of the reasons why this is so hard is, you know, it's one thing to give somebody something here. People had it and are, you know, taking it away. And that's what's been, you know, the source of a lot of the trouble. But also if a, you know, an employer can have a no remote work policy, but they have to be prepared to make exceptions for it. One of the difficulties with that is that an employer can't discuss why, you know, this particular employee is being allowed to work remotely, because that would be disclosing, you know, information about a disability. So if somebody says, well, how come Joe Smith gets to work from home and I don't, they can't say, well, you know, Joe suffers from severe depression. That leads to morale problems.
So what do they say, though? Because we also have here in Connecticut a law that says that you can ask what that person's making and why are they making more than I am if we have the same role. Like, what does an employer say then if I say, hey, we have the exact same job, but this person gets to do the show remotely from home? Why am I still coming in studio to do it? What does an employer say?
The employer says, I'm not able to discuss it, or something along those lines. Not saying it's easy. But that is the best way to resolve it because they can't disclose it. Now, sometimes, you know, I've represented employees where I've said to address the morale problem, let people know about it, you know, that's why I am getting, you know, this accommodation. But there's no easy fix here.
Interesting. And what rights does an employer have to say, you know what, I don't believe in remote working, and I'm really sorry that you have discovered after the pandemic that you have all this anxiety and that coming back to work is not going to work? Like, what rights do they have to remove you from the team if remote working is something that is now a non-negotiable for you as an employee? What can an employer do to say, well, we don't believe in that?
Well, it's different to, you know, it's one thing to say we don't believe in it, but that belief may lead to a charge being filed against the employer. And that is happening with you know, more frequency, because what the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Connecticut Fair Employment Practices Act says that as an accommodation, you know, the employer needs to be willing to at least consider changing workplace policies. Now, it's a different story if the nature of the job really requires being in the workplace. You know, someone who's a receptionist can't say, I want to do it remotely. Many jobs, and some say most jobs, really are not something that can be done full-time remotely or even part-time remotely. So that's the principal response from an employer, say, you can't perform the essential functions of your job remotely. That's become a harder argument because that was really what was argued most of the time before the pandemic. And now we've seen that a lot of jobs can be done remotely. And that's one of the reasons why I think courts are becoming a little more flexible, a little more skeptical of that defense by employers.
Interesting. And again, Gary Phelan, who is our employment attorney, he's with Mitchell and Sheehan, as well as a law adjunct professor at Quinnipiac University. Thank you so much for weighing in on this. It's a very interesting topic and certainly one we'll keep an eye on for sure. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.